Morning, everyone.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to Senate Finance. It's 9:04 on Thursday, February 26th. Bright sunny morning in Juneau on a welcome co-chair green. Morning. Senator Stevens, Senator Bundy, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman.
Morning to the committee. Purpose of today's meeting is to consider one new bill, Senate Bill 348, Royalty Oil Gas Contract. We're going to bring back before us for brief hearing Senate Bill 203 for some additional information. For the purposes of the calendar, Senate Bill 273, having to do with the ASME Board and seafood taxes and assessments, has been postponed. There's a CS being worked up, and that'll come back to us in the next few days. Ask folks at the table and in the audience to please turn off their cell phones and pagers. Senator Green, anything from the operating side before we begin? Nothing? Okay. Anything from the committee before we begin our deliberations? I want to welcome on the teleconference network Mr. Cole. Charlie is with us from Fairbanks, and we'll get the sheet here in just a moment. But I want to welcome Charlie. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, good morning, sir. Thanks for joining us this morning. And Charlie is available to answer questions as we proceed. We're going to have a presentation by the commissioner on Senate Bill 348. And then we will hear from Flint Hills. And anytime during either presentation, morning, Senator Hoffman.
Morning.
Anytime during any of the presentations, please feel free to interrupt. And as we work through this, Senator Terrio is with us this morning, and I'm not sure, Senator, you're going to join the commissioner at the table? Okay. Well, let's begin then. Senate Bill 348 provides legislative approval of a royalty oil contract between the state of Alaska and Flint Hills Resources, Alaska, for the sale of Alaska North Slope royalty oil. Presenting first this morning is the commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, Tom Irwin. Tom, morning, if you join us. And I think Kevin is with us. If you would, men, introduce yourselves and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Tom Irwin, Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources. And it's a real privilege to be with you today and talk about this proposed contract that we have in
Tom,
front of you.
Tom, can I interrupt? I'm sorry. I didn't do my homework. We need to adopt a CS. You have in front of you the committee of version D. That's the CS. Version A is one that was originally presented with the bill. The only difference is a matter of timing. Version A was drafted before the contract was signed. Version D is after the contract. So, Senator Green?
Mr. Chairman, I would move for consideration today the CS for Senate Bill 348, version D.
Mr. Chairman, may I object?
Objection to version D. Senator Bundy?
Object for a question. See, the, and maybe you've answered and I just didn't understand it. It discusses a contract dated February 9th and then the CS discusses February 25th. Is that what you had said to reimpose?
Lotus, notice line 7. And 8 speak to subject to prior review and recommendation by the Alaska Oilfield Royal and Gas Development Authority Board. That was drafted before they did the approval.
Okay.
Version D is after they've done their approval.
Remove my objection.
Further objection to adopting version D as our working document? Seeing none, version D is our working document. All right, Commissioner Irwin, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First off, I think it would be very appropriate if I gave introductions who's with me. I'd like to introduce Kevin Banks, Department of Natural Resources, our Senior Commercial Analyst. I would like to introduce Phil Reeves, Esquire, Department of Law. And Julian Mason, our contract negotiator for DNR, is not here, but he should also be recognized. Also with me is Mark Myers, our Director of Oil and Gas, and Janet Burleson Baxter, our legislative liaison. The committee and you, Mr. Chairman, have information. You should have a few packets. One is the best interest finding from myself, from the Department of Natural Resources. You should have the contract between the state and Flint Hills. You should have the resolution from the Royalty Board. And then you should have a packet of information from Mr. Banks that represents his presentation. I'll be very brief on my introduction remarks. And it's actually out of the best interest finding. From an in-depth consideration of the potential economic, environmental, and social impacts, and the various requirements for sale of the state's royalty oil, with a focus on the criteria specified under the terms of AS 3805-183, and that's specifically the requirements for the Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources, and AS 3806-070, that specifies the requirements for the Royalty Board to review. The Commissioner, I find that a negotiated long-term contract for the state's royalty oil to Flint Hills is in the state's best interest. This is an incredibly good contract, in my opinion, for the state, and a good contract means it's also good for the other party, the company. I think this really moves the state forward in several areas. Mr. Banks will address those areas. And in conclusion, I'd also again like to recognize in front of yourself the really good work this negotiating team did. It's a privilege to work with these kind of people, and with that, thank you, Kevin, and if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, I will turn it over to Kevin Banks.
Any questions of Commissioner Irwin? Senator Hoffman? Excuse me, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I actually read some of the articles that came on out related to this, and I think it's a great idea to have, obviously, the royalty gas that's supposedly to benefit the whole state of Alaska. As we look at this, and one of the comments that was pointed out was that the price of oil, or the price of the product, petroleum product down in Anchorage was going to be the same as the price there in Fairbanks. I guess I like the concept because it does serve the benefit of the business community, but are there any plans to extend those benefits throughout the state of Alaska so that the price of oil is a little more, or some of the places, some of the benefits are out there outside of the Fairbanks area?
Senator Olson, through the chair, we worked very hard, we meaning the negotiating team and the company negotiating team, and you walk a fine line. You don't want to compromise the principles of free trade. And you clearly have the issues of transportation. But we felt we were making a major step forward in the state to at least have the wholesale price started the same between Anchorage and Fairbanks. This is a major step forward. Of course, that does not impact the retail prices. You have issues of volume and, again, transportation, et cetera, from the various outlets. But it's a start. It's a step that this state is really taken that's never been taken before, to be fair to as many Alaskans as possible. How we convey that on into the more remote areas of Alaska, not addressed here, except those individuals ultimately get their wholesale prices based coming out of Anchorage and Fairbanks both. So it should bring more fairness around the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bundy?
Thank you. I did have some questions in this area as well, probably a little different motivation than Senator Olson. Is it fair to assume that the cost of producing would be the same in Fairbanks as it would in Anchorage, so that the wholesale price is a reflection of the actual cost?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, we were faced with two issues. One is you're faced with the open market competitiveness of materials being brought in from outside. product being brought from outside, specifically California or the West Coast. So you have that dynamic versus the dynamic that you have an active refinery in Fairbanks. So you can go both sides of the argument. If you're open market, you should get a cheaper price competitively in Anchorage than Fairbanks, because it open market dictates that's where the cheapest route is. On the other hand, to Alaskans, we all feel that a portion that is truly Alaskan gas. And it should then, by that logic, be cheaper where it's made and you don't have the shipping cost to Anchorage. We felt what was fairest for Alaskans was to try and treat Alaskans all fairly, and that drove to the wholesale price desire to be the same.
Senator Bundy? I certainly applaud the fairness. One way to achieve that, of course, is to have a higher wholesale price in Anchorage to support the wholesale price in Fairbanks, and that kind of begs the question of fairness a little bit for me.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I think the real intent is not to raise the price at one end to make it fairer in the other. We still have a competitive system with the outside world, and I believe this company has to be competitive across the board also.
If I might, thank you, and then I guess I would appreciate more information about the encouragement to develop a fuel system in Fairbanks so that they can, of course, compete with the Anchorage International Airport.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I believe those issues will be addressed as Kevin goes down through each light item, if I may.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Kevin, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kevin Banks. I work for the Department of Natural Resources at the Division of Oil and Gas as their commercial analyst. And today I'm going to try to give you a rundown, a little background on the on our RIK royalty in kind program, and to discuss the highlights of this contract for your benefit.
Do we have your slides?
Yes, I brought them yesterday, and I think I see some of them here. Senator, if you would like,
which piece do you have?
Here they are.
Are you speaking to this?
I just hadn't gotten.
Does everyone have this?
Yours were black and white, and mine are color.
Sorry,
we made sure you got the better ones.
Well, does that be fair?
Thank you. Williams. I believe about almost 2 years ago decided that to sell its refining assets throughout the country, and of course Alaska was a major part of that sale. And as a part of securing a customer, that customer required a long-term oil contract from the state as a condition of the purchase of that refinery. And that's what we have done here. We've offered a 10-year contract to Flint Hills, as you've seen here, and that will enable Flint Hills then to acquire the Williams refinery. Now, I may point out that in the acquisition of the refinery and all of Williams's assets here in Alaska, the gas stations and the Williams convenience stores will be sold to a company called Holiday, so the signs on these stations soon will not say Williams, nor will it say Flint Hills, but it will. They'll be Holiday stores, a marketer of gasoline that some of you may be familiar with, because they do a considerable business in the Midwest. Flint Hills will acquire the refinery and some of the terminaling facilities in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and a piece of the TAPS oil pipeline. The Lynx outlet at the Anchorage Airport will not be part of the package that Flint Hills will acquire. I believe that their joint venture partners had a right of first refusal and will assume ownership of that facility. To make sure we're all on the same page in the definition of RIK and RIV, royalty in kind, let me take a step back. We own basically 1/8 of the production of oil on the North Slope, give or take a few percentage points. And we can take that in value or we can take it in kind. When we take it in value, the lessees take it to the marketplace on their own benefit and pay us in cash. When we take it in kind, we take physical possession of the oil and resell it to our own customers. And we've been doing this now on the North Slope for a little over 25 years. The first oil contract we ever had off of the North Slope was from Prudhoe Bay. It was a 25-year agreement with Earth Resources Company, which later became MAPCO. And then Williams acquired this contract when they bought the refinery and MAPCO's assets in 1995. That contract expired at the end of 2003 in December. Over the years, we've had a couple of other smaller contracts or shorter-term contracts. In 1997, we had a one-year contract, and in 1998, a five-year contract, which also has just expired. Those two short-term contracts had price terms that were based on the amount we would have received had we left the oil in value with a 15-cent premium. The long-term 25-year contract had no such premium. So we've been working with the refinery to establish a slightly higher value for our oil when we sell it in kind over the last few years. In negotiating this contract with Flint Hills, and I need to tell you that the decision to go with Flint Hills was made after reviewing the marketplace and discussing the potential requirements of other buyers in the state and what those other buyers may be able to offer the state. And we elected to begin negotiations with Flint Hills back in at the end of July. And negotiations with Flint Hills started in earnest in August. In the process of negotiating this contract, we've relied on the techniques and expertise of our own staff, but also went out to look to advice from a firm, Baker & O'Brien, in Dallas, Texas, to review various aspects of the sale, including the issues related to gasoline parity, price, wholesale gasoline price parity, and the effectiveness and the kind of competition that exists for jet fuel in Fairbanks and in Anchorage. In fact, there's a jet fuel price parity term in this agreement as well. This outside consultant also reviewed aspects of the pricing provision to make sure that the state was in the market as it sold its oil, and then also wanted to make sure that that the kind of premium that we hope to receive would be achieved over time.
Excuse me, Kevin. Senator Bundy?
Thank you. And I don't mean it sounds so parochial, but jet fuel price parity. If I pump 100,000 gallons in one location and 3 million in another, I would expect through volume that I would have a lower price at the 3 million, and yet it sounded as if you're like you're going to put in a price support that no matter what the volume, it's going to cost the same.
The term of the contract, through the chair, Senator Bundy, expressly says that a customer in Anchorage, who is also a customer of Flint Hills in Fairbanks, will pay the same price. Customers are differently situated, as you've observed. So the high-volume customers may enjoy a different price than, say, smaller operators, or operators that have terms of sale that have credit provisions that are different than others. So the specific language in the agreement says that the same customer will pay the same price in either location. And in fact, in the last few years, that's actually what the market is doing. But we have made that a condition of this agreement.
If they will pay the same price regardless of the cost.
The cost is not the only aspect in the marketplace. There's also the issue of demand. And I think it is correct to say that high-volume customers may enjoy lower prices than the lower-volume customers. But that customer will be able to buy jet fuel in both locations for the same price.
Sounds a great deal like artificial price supports to me, and I think they didn't work well in the farming community either. Thank you.
Kevin, would you pull that microphone just a little bit closer to you, please?
Thank you. The contract provisions, I'll zip through those as quickly as I can, but we're here to ask for your approval under AS 3806055. The Royalty Board February 17th also approved this contract, and under their statutes, I think it's AS 3806070, has also reviewed this contract, adopted by reference the Commissioner's best interest finding, and approved the contract and has made a recommendation to the legislature to also approve it. Among the items in that I delivered to the committee yesterday is their resolution for your information, resolution 04-1. And the contract provisions, just very quickly, the quantity of oil that we will be selling to Flint Hills initially will be between 56,000 and 77,000 barrels per day, and this allows for some seasonal swing in their requirements. In the summertime, they make more gasoline and fuels than they do in the wintertime. Once every 12 months, Flint Hills can request a change in that quantity, either up or down, but the maximum will never exceed 77,000 barrels, or 85% of our total royalty production on the North Slope. There's a minimum quantity provision in the contract for 24,000 barrels a day, about a third of their initial quantity, and they may not go below that volume for the first 5 years of the contract. In the second 5 years of the contract, once a year, Flint Hills may revisit its volume requirements. And if it requests to go below 24,000 barrels, why, it has to go to zero. In other words, the contract will continue to live. The requirements for these special commitments that we will talk about later they're still obliged to meet those commitments, even though for that year they may not be taking any oil. They come back after 12 months and can ask the commissioner for an increase, but the commissioner may refuse. Say, for example, we have committed our oil to another customer, and we don't have the oil available to sell to Flint Hills, which certainly could occur. And so Flint Hills takes a chance if it reduces its oil that it may not be able to increase it. There's a certain element in here that we were trying to achieve that would limit, to a certain extent, Flint Hills' ability to arbitrage our oil against the marketplace to our disadvantage, because then we would lose the benefit of this contract, but also to the disadvantage perhaps of other producers, which would not have access, for example, to marine transportation to move oil out of Alaska, and are kind of a natural seller in the Alaska market. We didn't want our contract to form some kind of price cap for oil to their disadvantage, and in fact to our own disadvantage when they pay royalties and taxes on that oil, those producers do. The price, we believe, will achieve in the future a premium of about 30 cents per barrel. And that translates to, at those initial volumes, of about $8 million a year.
Kevin, pardon me for interrupting. What is Williams currently arrange pulling off of the pipeline?
Williams, at the moment, we are selling Williams between 50 and 55,000 barrels a day. They actually take a good deal more of that off the pipeline, but then re-inject all but the 55,000 or so barrels that we sell them, and they may acquire from others. So it's about a ratio of about 220 or 30,000 barrels flow through the refinery, and about 50 or 60 or 70,000 stays there to be turned into products.
When was the last time they were at 24,000 barrels a day?
It would have been within the last three or four years, and that would have been on only month by month occasions. I've included in my presentation an equation of the calculation of the RAK price. The points to be made about this is that this is the way the market prices oil in Alaska when it's sold at pump station one. And so we are modeling our contract after the commercial deals you see done between producers and the in-state refineries and among themselves and as they ship them away from Alaska. The $1.55, we take ANS and subtract $1.55, that number represents, I'll call it the RIK deduction, but it represents in our royalty settlements and in the deals done among others as the component for marine transportation, the deduction for tankers to take our oil to the West Coast. And it's in that number that we're also capturing the market value of our oil here in Alaska. It's our prediction that over time, the difference between this $1.55 here and the allowance that the royalty payers, the lessees who pay us for our royalty in value, will be about 30 cents difference. In other words, their deduction is roughly $1.85. Our deduction, because it's smaller, yields a higher price for our royalty in kind. If we look backwards, there's that graphic I show here illustrates that over time, because of other factors in this equation that are different than the royalty in value calculations made by the lessees, we actually have received more than 30 cents in the past. Specifically, the spot price that we use here in the in our RAK contract differs in certain instances for the destination value that is incorporated in the royalty settlements we have with the lessees. And it yields, almost another 30 cents to our favor. In fact, over the last 4 years, had we had this contract price term inserted in the Williams agreement, we would have made about 52 cents more for our royalty. Now, having said that, I expect that as we negotiate and work with the royalty and value payers, our lessees, that we will try to achieve an ANS spot price or something more reflective of the West Coast market. And in fact, we've been able to move towards that through reopeners and renegotiations with them. So I think it's safe to say that the real difference in the premium that we expect to receive under this contract is developed in the difference between that $1.55 deduction and the transportation deduction that the producers take. Special commitments, in addition to this premium, and quite unique in this contract is the fact that Flint Hills has agreed to several special commitments that we've already discussed briefly. Installation of clean fuels equipment, maybe up to $100 million of investments in the state of Alaska and at the refinery to produce low sulfur diesel fuels in time to meet EPA requirements by the end of 2006. The alternative to producing those fuels in the state of Alaska is to have them imported. They have committed to continue to work with the Government Hill Community Council and meet the agreements made initially by Williams, and to expedite the commitments made to the Government Hill Community Council to remove tanks west of the West Dock Road, or sorry, east of the West Dock Road, as they build new tanks west of the road. And in addition to that, they will participate and continue to participate in an evaluation of the environmental improvements and hazards at the hazard study at the tank farm. They will assume a 10-year contract with the Alaska Railroad to continue shipping jet fuel and gasoline on the railroad from Fairbanks to Anchorage.
Senator Bundy?
Point on that, or question on that point, if I might. Why the insistence on the commitment to the railroad? Why not just suggest you ship it as economically as possible?
I think they may be the same thing, Senator, through the chair. The alternative to Flint Hills would be to construct a pipeline. And our history with this is that with the renegotiation of transportation agreements with the railroad, I think that was a real concern for the railroad that a pipeline might be sought as an alternative. But I believe that rail shipment remains the most economical way of moving product from Fairbanks to Anchorage, and it is consistent. I mean, I think on one hand, Flint Hills, I don't think, would have made this agreement or would have been willing to assume this contract had there been a problem in that regard.
Might be a question to ask Flint Hills, Senator Bundy, when they visit with us after this presentation.
Yes, thank you. But then, of course, this might provide more business, so the railroad could provide a dividend to the state, too. Hope springs eternal.
Subject for another day. Job security. Kevin, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Flint Hills has also agreed to work with the state at the Fairbanks International Airport to evaluate the fuel supply system there and possibly make improvements to the terminal and to the hydrant system if it's economically feasible to revive that that system. In addition, they've agreed to promote Fairbanks among air cargo carriers. And I'd like to make a sort of respond to Senator Bundy's concerns here. Fairbanks is ideally situated geographically to serve shipments of cargo from Asia to Europe. Anchorage is slightly more favored for shipments from Asia to the lower 48. So while there is competition among the two airports, I think it's the Asia to Europe and other locations that is more naturally fit for Fairbanks. So what we're looking to do here, I think, is to increase total cargo movements for the whole state. And see that Fairbanks can perhaps pull the competition from the former Soviet Union, where shipments are now crossing into Europe. They've also agreed, as we mentioned, to set jet fuel parity for the same customer in each location. Wholesale gasoline rack price parity. There's a couple points I'd like to make.
Kevin, before you go to that,
yes.
We have a question. Senator Stevens?
Excuse me.
On the pricing, before you get too far along, Mr. Banks, on your, pardon me, on your slide here that calculates the price calculation for those RIK price.
Yes, sir.
And I'm trying to relate it to the just a point of clarification from my own, and to your best interest finding determination on page 8. Just so that I can understand this, so you've got the spot price minus the tanker tariff, the transportation cost, minus the interstate PAPS tariff. So is that the tariff allowance in number three that you have on page eight?
Yes, it's an interstate tariff.
And then so the next one was the quality bank adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
And then minus the line loss. So the first question is, the line loss seems almost an insignificant number. Is that because of the fact that the line's not full and you're not displacing any other product?
Line loss refers to, it previously had been a much larger number because oil was used out of the pipeline to fuel the pumps along the way.
Right.
Now that is not the case. And so line loss is truly a change in volume as the oil cools in the pipeline, as the balance of inventories on either end get a bit mixed up. But that's exactly right. It's a fairly small number, about a penny or a penny and a half at normal prices.
But I guess my question is then you go down to the Flint Hills price minus royalty field cost payment. So is that the piece that's explained in the bottom paragraph on page 8?
Actually,
that it's the upstream cost to get the state bears the cost to get the crude to pump one, then? Is that?
Not exactly, no. The royalty and value payers, the lessees, are entitled to a field cost deduction as whether we take the oil in kind or in value. By setting Flint Hills' price above that line, we then receive sufficient credit to pay the royalty and value field cost deduction.
Well,
and
okay.
So the point of bringing that to your attention in this table is to show that we have met the requirement that the royalty and value when we sell it is the same or greater than what we received when we take our oil in value.
Okay.
Net of those deductions.
I see. I understand that. Yeah. So on the back up above in the interstate TAP tariff and in your definition on the best interest finding, the tariff allowance allows for the FERC rate, but then I'm confused here on how you. That the state bears the cost of the tariffs essentially north of pump one. Am I reading that correctly?
Through the chair, Senator, yes. What this refers to, in my little table here in my price slide, this would assume that you're taking oil from Prudhoe Bay right there at pump station one.
Right.
If we take oil from Kuparik River Unit, there is a tariff between of about 20 some cents between pump one and the Kuparik River unit.
So,
and that will be then deducted for the volumes of oil taken from Kuparik, and similarly other upstream units.
Well, that's not negotiated into this tariff rate, so we would just absorb that on a different transaction outside of this then?
No, the deduction is incorporated in their price. So we'll see a lower price. Yes, it is, sir. It'll be
If you take fuel from Kuparik or from Alpine, that's going to be incorporated into that price?
Yes, so it'll be Kuparik oil then will have a net back, so to speak, that will be lower than the pump station one price for Prudhoe Bay. And that's the same way we calculate the lessee's royalty and value.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Go ahead, please, Kevin.
On the going back to the wholesale gasoline rack price parity, that's based on, as I think Tom Irwin, Commissioner Irwin, had explained this pretty well. We're looking at wholesale prices, and these are prices that are posted in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and it provides us a somewhat transparent means of verifying whether or not gasoline at the rack is being sold at the same price in both places. Here again,
A question was asked, doesn't it cost the same in both markets to make the gasoline? So either you'd expect it to be the same or perhaps higher. And the concern was is that, well, I hope Anchorage doesn't see an increase in price in order to match this parity. I think it's important to recognize that the markets are different. And in Anchorage, there's actually an excess supply of gasoline produced and has to be exported. So the next best alternative for sellers of wholesale gasoline is to carry it away somewhere, or to reduce the production of refinery output at the Tesoro refinery in Nikiski. So there are pressures in Anchorage to for lower prices that don't exist in Fairbanks. So this does achieve a benefit for the consumers in Fairbanks, but not at a cost to the consumers in Anchorage. Local hire, the contract requires, and Flint Airless has agreed to hire local employees when they're available and capable of doing the job. We have estimated that this $100 million clean fuels project will have a fairly significant construction employment impact, although not a very large ongoing long-term impact on employment. But employment at the refinery today is about 150 full-time equivalent jobs and a payroll of between $8 and $12 million. There's a slide on present and projected local regional needs for oil and gas products. I'll leave it for you to read. There are just a few facts there, except that to say that as a part of this agreement, Flint Hills has agreed to take all commercially reasonable efforts to use our royalty oil in their refinery. In the previous contracts with Williams, the requirement was for at least 80% of our oil to be used in the refinery. But this is a way of assuring that those employment benefits and other benefits of operating the refinery in North Pole are attributable to this sale of oil. And that concludes my remarks on the sale, and if there are any more questions, I'd be delighted to hear them.
Questions to Senator Huffman?
Mr. Chairman, in your deliberations, was there any consideration given to the difference in incorporation, Flint Hills being an LLC, and the limits there and their tax structure? And the liabilities and those of their predecessor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Huffman, yes, it was. It was actually sometimes painful discussions about that. In particular, our concern was as an LLC and as a privately held corporation, we didn't have the same kind of visibility in the financial strength of this firm that we would have been afforded under Williams as a publicly held corporation subject to the kind of SEC requirements for reporting that you see for a firm like that. So we've established a provision in this agreement that a financial advisor will be retained to examine the Flint Hills' financial picture and their perspective, their expectations about how they will he'll be in the future, and report to the state how healthy this company is. If it should fall below a certain bond rating, and this information appears in the security clauses in the contract. If it falls below a certain rating, why then Flint Hills will be required to post a bond, or excuse me, a standby letter of credit with the state equivalent to the production or the sale of 190 days of sale oil, about $110 to $120 million LC.
Can you explain to me the difference between a standby letter and an actual bond?
I think I can. A standby letter of credit is made out to us, and almost, there's almost unfettered ability for the commissioner to cash it if a problem arises with this contract, say failure of payment or default of a, for whatever reason.
My second question, I guess, was the tax situation between an LLC, for the state of Alaska, between an LLC and a corporation. Is there going to be differences in this area?
I don't think so, but I don't know the answer to that, Senator. Mr. Chair.
Anybody in the audience might be able to help with that? Senator Bundy?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm not a tax attorney, but I, it's my understanding that LLCs do not pay corporate income tax.
They don't pay income tax, so that was one of the questions that I wanted. In your fiscal note that you provided us, it shows that there's 77,000 barrels a day, and then you have a consistent change in revenue. And, you know, you don't give backup, and we just received this letter from the governor stating that, you know, that the revenues may vary, and I wonder, you know, how, if you can explain this fiscal note and what happens to the royalties if they consistently are at the 25 or 24,000 barrel or a day rate, and what does that mean to our treasury?
At 24,000 barrels a day, revenues to the state will be an incremental $2.6 million a year based on this 30-cent premium that I discussed. And of course, that's the alternative. The oil, if we're not selling the oil to Flint Hills, of course, it's being taken away in value. So it's that, that's the range we can look at is $2.6 to $8.4 million. But I suspect that we'll see in the initial part of this contract that the 56 to 77,000 barrel range that is the initial quantity will be what Flint Hills will take from us.
I guess somewhere along the line, if we can get an answer from someone on the tax, the change in taxes to the state's coffer as a result of the change of someone that might receive these royalties under incorporation versus an LLC. I think that would be of interest to this committee, if not at least to myself.
Sir. We'll do that.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
Senator Bundy?
Thank you. I can see you and get confused. We both wear glasses. I guess it depends on how you define the state, but I still have questions about benefit to the state. I'd like further amplification about how it's a benefit to the state to guarantee shipment by rail when the Alaska Railroad is a quasi-private enterprise. And then the refinery and employees generating $3 to $4 million a year in property tax. My understanding that doesn't go into the state coffers, so I would question it. At least how I define benefits to the state, and that would be a benefit to the state. Thank you.
Other questions of the administration? Seeing none, thank you for being with us this morning. I'd like to call to the table the folks from Flint Hills Resources Alaska. Have them join us and visit a bit with them. We have Mr. Alan Lassiter. Alan is going to be the president of Flint Hills Resources Alaska. And Mr. Alan Wright. Alan is the Government Affairs Director for Flint Hills. And with that brief introduction, I'd ask that you each introduce yourself.
Bless you.
Excuse me.
And I'm not sure who's going to go first, but welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alan Wright. I'm Vice President of Public Affairs for Flint Hills Resources. And to my right is Alan Laster, who you mentioned will become the President of Flint Hills, Alaska, currently as Vice President of Environmental Health and Safety for Flint Hills. We are both right now based in Wichita, Kansas. Alan hopefully will be based in Fairbanks here in the near future. First of all, before I begin Flint Hills Resources, I want to compliment the team that preceded me in that through our negotiations with the state on this contract, they were able representatives and stewards of your precious resource, and we compliment them on their due diligence, and we were pleased to engage in those negotiations with them and feel like that we came out at the end with a product that was both beneficial to our company and our business and hopefully to the people of Alaska. So with that, draw your attention to a handout that we had provided the committee in advance, and I'll walk through those slides briefly and certainly can field questions at your pleasure. Flint Hills Resources is a leading producer of fuels, base oils for lubricants and other petrochemical and commodity products. We are a Wichita-based Kansas company, a wholly owned subsidiary of Koch Industries, that's K-O-C-H, not the soft drink version. We're positioned to build on more than six decades of refining in the chemical industry experience. Our company is tightly focused on achieving its goals through growth and success. We have a culture based on principled entrepreneurship, which means it strives to combine a rock-solid commitment to acting with integrity and with unwavering desire to anticipate and cost-effectively satisfy our consumer needs. The discovery mentality cultivated in our more than 2,000 employees drives us towards innovation that's resulted in developing a value-added fuels for our customers and achieving important safety, efficiency, and environmental protection goals in our operation. These core set of values shared by our employees include honesty, openness, and customer focus, and it's a key to building a business that is sustainable over a long time. Our facilities, and on the next slide, we have two refineries, one in Minnesota, located in what we call Pine Bend, but in between the twin cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul. Our daily processing capacity in that refinery is roughly 280,000 barrels a day. We're one of the largest heavy crude, sour crude refiners in the U.S. We have in this market as well as in Texas brought clean fuels to that market early in advance of the federal guidelines. We have produced a product we call Blue Planet, which is marketed by Holiday, which has resulted in reduction of emissions and has garnered recognition from the American Lung Association for that product. In Corpus Christi, we have a refining and a chemical complex. We produce over 300,000 barrels a day there. We have over 900 employees at that complex, plus 250 contract workers. Primarily, we provide refined products for the Central Corridor of Texas from Corpus Christi up through Austin, San Antonio, Waco, and Dallas-Fort Worth. The next slide gets us to the point of today on the Alaska acquisition. We've been in these negotiations and discussions both with Williams and the state for quite some time. In November, we announced a purchase and sell agreement with Williams that was contingent upon ultimate approval of this contract by the state, and we hope to be able to finalize that in the near future. We're excited about the opportunity that we have here. We, as Kevin and the commissioner mentioned are committed to bringing a number of enhancements to this facility, including clean fuels. In Canada, we operate a transportation supply business, which is based on almost 40 years of experience there, where we produce or purchase a great deal of crude that supplies our refinery in Pine Bend, Minnesota. We also currently have an interest in an oil sands project located in the Athabasca region.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. In Texas or in Canada, do you have similar agreements where you're required to transport your product by a particular mode of transportation?
Senator Bundy, would you get closer to that microphone?
I'm sorry. In Canada or in Texas, do you have the similar agreement like you'd have in Alaska where you're required to transport your product by a particular form of conveyance?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, we operate in Texas on a proprietary pipeline, too, actually, that we own. I believe in Canada we transport either by truck or through other common carrier lines.
Thank you.
But we do not have a requirement to transfer by one means or the other.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
All right, very good. On the base oil slide, we have currently, we bought a joint venture interest in a company called XL Paralubes located in Lake Charles, Louisiana. That basically provides the base oil for motor oil and other lubricants. In our fuels marketing, we have a diverse operation of over 160 terminal locations that we work through throughout the central U.S., Great Lakes, Southeast, and Central Atlantic regions where we market gasoline, jet fuel, diesel, heating oil, and performance fuels. On environmental health and safety, we put safety and environmental excellence first in the way that we conduct our business. Our company's culture conveys a personal responsibility for safety on and off the job. We have a clear vision for excellent and management systems that demand environmentally responsible decisions, actions, and safety. The company strives for 100% compliance while meeting the expectations of the commodities in which we operate. Our high priority of stewardship programs and clean fuel initiatives are helping to solve environmental challenges for customers and neighbors. As I mentioned before, both in Texas and Minnesota, we have brought clean fuels to the market well in advance of the federal guidelines. Continuing on our EH&S aspects, I'd mentioned in Minnesota, our criteria air emissions, which is basically a per barrel from our refinery, are 43% lower than the average for our peer facilities compared to the most recently publicized data. We have embarked on a 5 and 50 plan of reducing our emissions at our Pine Bend facility by 50% in 5 years, and we are currently making that goal. As I'd also mentioned, the American Lung Association has endorsed our product, Blue Planet, in the Twin Cities.
Senator Bundy?
Thank you, and I apologize for the interruptions. I'm just curious about the Blue Planet gasoline. I'm a little bit familiar with Minnesota, and if you can operate there, you're to be congratulated. How is that gasoline different than what's currently being produced in North Pole, and would you be interested in moving in that direction, and why?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, and I'll also defer to Alan to get into more of the process technical questions, but I believe Blue Planet will be similar to the clean fuel product that we will bring. The virtue of Blue Planet was that it was early. But
that's correct. The Blue Planet fuel is low sulfur gasoline. That meets the 2006 in Minnesota requirements, and we began making that several years early. The Those requirements kick in the state of Alaska in January of 2007, and we'll be making fuel that's very similar to Blue Planet.
Mr. Laster, if you would, just so that your voice matches up with the text, if you would just identify yourself, please, for the...
This is Alan Lassiter. Will be president of Flint Hills Resources, Alaska.
Senator Bundy, did that take care of your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
All right, continuing on, two more points on this issue. Transparency is very important to our company. In Minnesota, again, we have formed an alliance with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy to launch a website that posts instant access to our environmental performance data and statistics, which allows residents, near neighbors, other interested folks to know what's going on at our refinery there. In Corpus Christi, we've received recognition from OSHA for our safety record and have reached what's referred to as a VPP star status, which is a very hard measure, very high standard to meet through OSHA, and our facility there has received that recognition. And moving on, in our commitment to the community, and we understand in our discussions both with the state and with people in the community that there's a high expectation here, as there is everywhere, that we become a full community partner. And I can tell you that wherever we operate, we are a full participant in the community. In Wichita, we've supported, which is where our corporate headquarters is, we support a number of programs. We're members of the Nature Conservancy. We've sponsored environmental education at a nature center in Minneapolis. We've done a great deal of conservation work on the Mississippi River, which actually borders our facility there. We've been a sponsor of a children's program with the Ordway Theater, a major arts center in downtown St. Paul. We are a premier partner with the Science Museum of Minnesota, where we've sponsored dinosaur exhibits, children's programs, where people from outside of the Twin Cities are brought into the institution to learn about science-based education. We, from a safety standpoint, participate in joint fire training with other local fire departments there and around our facility. In Corpus Christi, we're involved in science-based environmental teaching programs. We participate in a mano-a-mano scholarship program in Corpus Christi for Hispanic youth, support of a children's hospital in the Texas State Aquarium. These are just a few of the commitments that we have that represent the values that we hold. To conclude, we're a company that strives to add value both to our customers and to the communities in which we operate. If you will know from our history where we've invested, we have tended to grow. We are, as it's been mentioned, a privately held company, which means that we generally are in for the long haul, and both in Minnesota and in Corpus Christi, if you looked at where those facilities were when we bought them and where they are now, they've grown and become full partners in the community. I appreciate the committee's attention, and we are open for questions.
Thank you, Alan. Questions of Mr. Wright? And also, just to highlight, Dave also passed out this environmental brochure. I think you all have that. Mr. Laster, good morning. Any presentation you'd like to make?
No presentation at all. We are very much looking forward to moving to Alaska, to getting involved in the community, to making the modifications required to keep this refinery viable in the future. The clean fuels investments that we have mentioned that we will be making are going to be required to keep the refinery in the gasoline business after 2007, in the diesel fuel business after the middle of 2006. We think we can bring great things to the state of Alaska, and we're looking forward to the opportunity.
Let's talk a little bit about that expansion. I remember back maybe in the mid-90s, I think it was Williams at that time, but I remember they did a significant expansion out there. I remember it increased their production by 40% or 60%. I'm trying to frame that with a $100 million investment in diesel. Do you remember what, or do you know what that investment was at that time?
I believe in 1998, Williams started up their third crude unit, which was a 100,000-barrel-a-day crude unit. Mm-hmm. I might have to rely on Jeff Cook from Williams for the precise investment figures, but my recollection is $70 or $80 million.
Is that correct, Jeff?
$71 million.
So that's about a $71 million investment, and this diesel conversion is $100 million, so it's significant. Does the conversion then give you only one kind of diesel, or will there be two kinds of diesel in Alaska?
There will be the potential to have two kinds of diesel in Alaska. The federal rules for on-road diesel in 2006 is that the sulfur content can be no higher than 15 parts per million. Off-road diesel and some of the other sources things like heating fuel can still be higher sulfur levels. We expect that over time there are some proposed rules by EPA that would reduce the sulfur content of those streams as well.
Does the conversion to the cleaner sulfur, does that increase your takeout from the pipeline? Does it increase your demand?
It should not increase the demand.
And what is the timeline for that, to start that $100 million investment?
We have begun engineering on the project last fall. The timeline is, we would say, critically tight for 2006. The basic timeline is this year we will be completing engineering, next year probably during the construction season, installing foundations, and then in 2006 installing the equipment. We feel confident that we can make the 2007 gasoline timeline that's required. The 2006 diesel requirement kicks in June, and as all of you know, probably better than we do, the construction season in the interior is very short, and our ability to get that construction done prior to June is somewhat in question right now.
Senator Bundy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, $100 million investment, the challenges of subarctic construction, how will that translate to impacts on the wholesale price of product, gasoline and diesel? Is that too far in the future to speculate? I've got to assume that if you have to put in money, you need to recover it somewhere, and that would be from the consumer.
Well, clearly, the cost of producing the fuel will go up. However, as we have found over the years, the refining business is not a cost-plus-based business. The free market basically dictates what prices that we can charge for our products. So the price may go up, it may not go up. It really depends what the overall competition situation with the rest of the free market would hold. Clearly our costs will go up though. If those costs are ultimately passed on to the consumers, we really can't say. We don't know.
Thank you.
Mr. Lassiter, we had questions earlier about the Alaska Railroad, your relationship shipping on the railroad vis-a-vis a pipeline. Is there anything you'd like to add to that discussion?
I believe that the reason that term was placed into the contract at the request of the state probably relates to a couple of factors. The refinery is something approaching 50% of the gross revenue of Alaska Railroad. We were to elect to ship by some other method, and I think the only practical method would be a pipeline, That would conceivably be quite an impact to the state as far as the viability of the railroad. However, at the termination of the contract, I mean, that still is an option that we have available to us to build a pipeline rather than to ship via railroad.
Senator Bundy?
Safe to say that the railroad requirement was not an initiative that you folks brought forth.
That's safe to say. However, it's also safe to say that for the foreseeable future, there's really no other option.
Thank you.
What is the date for Holiday to take over the convenience stores?
The way the transaction is structured, Flint Hills will take over the refinery and Holiday will take over the convenience stores on the same day. They will close together.
We would be remiss if we didn't ask you to talk about one of our favorite subjects, and that's local hire. So I'd just like to hear you maybe emphasize the commitment that we heard prior from the administration.
Okay. I think in terms of local hire, as it regards the current personnel at the facility, we very much view the current workforce as a key part of this acquisition, a key part of the success of this business over the long term. That's not to say that we won't be bringing in some leadership people from our company to lead the business, to fill in some gaps that we've seen in the organization, to do things of that sort. Many times in acquisitions, an acquisition may be viewed as a turnaround story where the only way to make the business profitable is to reduce staff significantly, to reduce costs significantly. This is not one of those acquisitions. We very much intend to continue largely with the staff that's in place as we go forward into the future, and we add a number of different processing lines with the clean fuels investment. We will need more operating staff. We will need more maintenance staff. We'll probably need more management staff. Our expectation would be that the workforce at the refinery will grow over time. I think also our expectation would be as we install the new equipment, there will be clearly some contracting jobs in the community that will also support the Fairbanks area.
Thank you. Other questions from Flint Hills? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure who to go ahead and present this question to, but one of the concerns obviously here within the state of Alaska is the fragility of the tundra and oil spills and those kind of issues. Obviously, the Yukon River is one of the rivers that may be affected if there is a problem with the runoff going from the Tanana, because the fishing grounds are obviously in my district, so it's a concern that my constituents are going to have. And after looking at the history that Koch Industries has, within the last several years, there have been a number of pretty sizable settlements that have gone on related to spill-type issues in the amount of maybe $50 million. Whenever you look at something like that, it's something that draws everybody's attention to. In spite of the tremendous success, and I have to congratulate the Koch family for the success they've had in the oil business, despite the difficulty between the two brothers there, obviously. As we look at this, the spills and those kind of problems, especially up here in the state of Alaska, how do we get an assurance that we are going to have, as you pointed out, an honest and open relationship when back in 1999 there was a jury found in excess of 24,000 infractions related to maybe some questionable measuring practices related to oil acquisition, you know, that was quote-unquote stealing and maybe lied about. So I want to know, how can you assure us that they're downstream from the refinery, that indeed there are going to be safeguards in place so that we don't see another headline type in the paper?
Okay. Senator Olson, through the chair, I'm delighted to answer that question. First of all, we take full responsibility for our environmental record, good and bad. We are an energy company that's run by human beings, and we have had our mistakes. I'll answer those some of those questions specifically, but in general, it's an issue. Environmental health and safety and environmental excellence is a key priority of our company. As a result of a number of those issues, I would say that we're exactly the company that you would want, because we've learned a great deal from those experiences. We have systems in place, management systems, compliance systems, that allow us to prevent those kind of problems from happening in the future. Specifically, some of the issues that you raised, we had litigation in Corpus Christi, Texas, related to a Clean Air Act violation. The circumstances around that were an employee failed to file the proper paperwork with the federal government regarding some of our requirements. We found that out through an audit of our own, dismissed the employee, and turned ourselves in to the federal government. That resulted in some additional litigation. There were a number of counts lodged against the company that were reduced by the court, not through settlement. And we did plead to one count of filing false documents with the federal government, and have currently, you know, been convicted of that, and that's ongoing. The conviction is
probation.
We are
on probation.
Secondly, I believe the oil purchasing question related to purchase of crude oil on federal land. That's related, obviously, to a different company, a different part of Koch Industries. I believe that a jury found that, but they also found no wrongdoing on our part, and we admitted no wrongdoing. We did settle with the parties, and there was no admission of any guilt. And in this circumstance, we would not be buying crude oil from the wellhead. That will be done, obviously, by the producers in Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Huffman?
Just to follow up on that, I guess, those actions that Senator Olson had talked about, were those actions taken against a different structure, or was that those corporations also LLCs?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I don't know that I can answer that question. At various times, our Koch Industries has structured itself in different ways. So the entities that, the Corpus Christi matter, that was a division of Koch Industries at that time, called Koch Petroleum Group, which is our predecessor company. Crude oil purchasing entity was Koch Oil at that time. And so I don't know if they were LLCs. I can't.
With your recollection, to the best of your knowledge, they were not LLCs.
I can't answer that question specifically, but can get that for you.
I'd appreciate that, because I think the limited liability corporations have less liability, and that's the reason for those corporations. So, what protections are we getting? Even though you're moving in the right direction, there have, as Senator Olson says, there have been actions taken, successful actions taken. And I would like to know, for my own peace of mind, what type of structures those were, and if they were limited liability corporations, would those same judgments have taken place?
Mr. Wright, you can get that for Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Okay, I will. Time.
And I might add, Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that our current structure, and the structure that we operate right now, is the performance that we've had. We've received a great deal of recognition from the EPA, through other environmental groups. So the structure that's coming to Alaska is performing at an industry leader level currently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions of Flint Hills? Seeing none, on behalf of the committee, I would like to welcome Mr. Lasseter, you personally, to Alaska. We look forward to working with you in Fairbanks. And welcome Koch Industries to Alaska. We look forward to working with you to make this a profitable experience for you as well as the people from Alaska. And we stand ready to help you do that. Mr. Cole, you can stay right there if you'd like. Mr. Cole, do you have any comments as a member of the Royalty Advisory Board?
No, sir.
Thanks for joining us this morning, Charlie. Mr. Reese? Bill? Would you just come forward and stand right there? I think we have an answer to Senator Hoffman's question in regard to LLCs and how the Department of Revenue will treat them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a definitive answer to the question, but I did relay the tax question through my colleagues who work directly with the tax issues, and they spoke with Revenue quickly. And the answer in general is that the state corporate income tax follows the federal corporate income tax, that most LLCs of any substantial financial capacity are treated as corporations for tax purposes under the federal corporate income tax. So we will get the definitive answer, but the people at Revenue did not have this question occur to them when they had this sale go past them. So they expect that it's likely that those will be, that they will be taxed as a corporation.
Thank you. And we'll get that in writing, and this bill has four or five more stops, so we'll make sure it's part of the packet as it moves along. Other questions or comments from the committee? Will of the committee?
And I would move SB 348 out of committee with individual recommendations and coming this month.
Is there objection to moving version D of Senate Bill 348 from committee with the fiscal notes? Seeing none, version D passes from committee. Thank you for being here this morning. Administration, thank you, Tom, for joining us this morning. And thank you to the committee for their consideration. We're going to move ahead and bring back before us Senate Bill 203, and let's stand at ease for just a moment while we get settled.
Fairbanks subsidy bill.
You guys get the Fairbanks.
Let's come back to order.
All right, Con.
Bring back before us Senate Bill 203. Senate Bill 203 creates an independent office of hearing officers within the Department of Administration under the direction of a chief administrative law judge. We heard this bill a couple of days ago. Mr. Stancliffe presented it to us. There were some questions, a couple of questions, one in regard to the structure, the other in regard to the fiscal note. Today, we thought we'd, just to save some time, we'd bring back before us a committee substitute, which is version D, which Dave will explain. The fiscal notes are still being worked, but they expect to be here today or Monday morning. So the plan would be is to get the CS explained and then marry up the fiscal notes on Monday morning, bring this back, and hopefully pass it on so it can travel on through the legislature. So that's the plan. We have version Z. Why don't you explain it, Dave, if you would, and then we'll ask for a motion to adopt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope it's a good sign that we've reached the end of the alphabet in our versions of this bill.
I'm Dave Stancliffe. I'm a staff to Admin Reg Review, chaired by Senator Terrio. If you would care to, I can walk through the changes before you adopt the CS as a working document. Is that what you prefer, Mr. Chairman?
Is there objection to adopting version Z of 203? Seeing none, then. Version Z is our working document.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The changes that we have are in part cleanup, in part things the drafter pointed out to us, who is Tam Cook in this particular instance, and part of the ongoing process of trying to meet the concerns, very legitimate, of the administration as we dovetail this reform into the existing system of regulations. I have a reference sheet here, and I can walk the committee through each change, if that would be your preference, Mr. Chairman.
Will of the committee? Anything in there, Dave, that is particularly of interest to us?
Okay. Well, let's start with some of the more substantive changes, because I think those are things that this committee can take some pride in reviewing and acting upon. The first one occurs on page 31 of the bill. 31. At the bottom of the bill, in section 66, it's actually line 30. A state hearing officer who had been with the state of Alaska for 25 years, recently retired, came in and suggested that he had run into instances where the hearing officers had worked for one jurisdiction, be it federal or a native tribe or a municipality, and were also doing hearing functions for the state, and he suggested that we just prohibit that type of conflict. And we had added in everything but municipality. But in thinking about it, municipal governments often challenge or are at odds with state regulations from time to time. And so I wouldn't want a hearing officer who was employed or under contract with a municipality also being a state hearing officer taking up the case. And so we added the word municipality in there on line 30. Number two,
Senator Olson.
Going to ask questions now about the particular ones, or have
well, let's ask him as we walk through them. Okay. That was number one. Go ahead, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stancliffe, as we look at this particular addition, I can understand that if you do have a hearing officer that is going to be trying different things in different areas and has the different entities that he's been working with, and I can understand even if you have it out in Anchorage or Fairbanks or Bethel for that matter, that if you have a hearing officer that's there hearing things, but then we have more than one hearing officer in town. But if you go up to more rural areas of Alaska, and you've only got one hearing officer, that means you got to bring in another hearing officer with added expense of travel, per diem, and all that other stuff. Instead of putting municipalities, is there a way around that? Is there, for example, can we put municipalities where there's either more than one hearing officer that they can recuse themselves, or if there's a town of greater than 10,000 that they can be have this exemption in place?
Mr. Chairman, beside me is Andy Henningway, a state hearing officer, and from his perspective of actually dealing in this world, he might be better qualified to answer that.
Senator Olson, through the chair, my name is Andy Henningway. I'm a hearing officer for the Department of Administration. right now, the state has approximately 25 or so hearing officers. And to the best of my knowledge, they are all located in Fairbanks, Anchorage, or Juneau. I don't believe that the state has any hearing officers within the scope of this legislation that are outside of the main municipal areas. So for hearings that are conducted in the other communities in the state, a hearing officer from one of those towns just either does it telephonically or goes out to the community for to conduct the hearing. Does that address your question?
It does to a certain degree, but I guess I cringe when I see that exception in there, that municipalities were involved.
Senator, through the chair, the concept here is it's basically conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're aiming at here. Most of the State Ethics Act, in fact, all of the State Ethics Act, the Executive Branch Ethics Act, talks about conflicts of interest that deal with financial conflicts of interest. In this area, what the concern was for hearing officers is the conflict of interest that could arise making decisions on behalf of one sovereign when there are other sovereigns with other policies and other interests that might pertain to the matter that you're adjudicating. And so that's the basis for it, is simply to ensure that there's no perception on the part of the public or any of the parties to the case that that a hearing officer who's deciding a state for the state of Alaska is is going to be thinking about anything other than the best interests of the state of Alaska and the arguments of the parties in front of them.
Last question, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding, though, that the hearing officer is supposed to be the neutral party. In a sense, essence, he's the judge that's there, and so how can he have a conflict of interest? In spite of his representation at certain periods of time that he is representing the state.
Well, it's the inherent conflict of interest between different sovereigns. I, as a hearing officer right now, I work for the state of Alaska. I'm going to continue to do so, or I would continue to do so under this. And some of the issues that are decided, for example, some municipal tax cases come in front of hearing officers. And sometimes a municipality is a party to the case, as it turns out. In fact, that's not uncommon in a lot of utility cases. Municipalities are often parties. So there are a lot of situations in which your job as the adjudicator on behalf of the state is could be perceived as affected by the interests of other sovereigns, and this is an attempt to be sure that in the hearing officer's mind, those kinds of issues won't be a problem because they won't have those kinds of alternative.
Just an additional comment, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like we're trying to protect ourselves from ourselves, and that's the, kind of one of the problems that I do have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Anything else on number one?
Mr. Chairman, hearing nothing else on that same page, in Section 65, we discovered that we had protected the ALJs and the central model, the model office, from inappropriate contact or influence by agencies or legislative branches of government, but we hadn't protected all other state hearing officers, and the insertion and the of this language in Section 65 now would suggest that hearing officers, no matter what level they were out there, if they're not to be unduly influenced under both the Administrative Ethics Act and the Legislative Ethics Act with regard to inappropriate contact. The hearing officers have a tough job, and we're trying to make sure that they are impartial, and that's the genesis of this change.
Questions on number two? Next, Dave.
Last year, the legislature took up, as a good faith effort, some new processes laid out by the Associated General Contractors with regard to dispute resolution. And that process has yet had a chance to work, and they asked that they be given a chance to work, and so we removed them from the jurisdiction of this bill, Mr. Chairman. That would be on a deletion on page 4. It won't show up, obviously. It's gone. But that's where the reference was.
It's actually on page
4. Okay. Andy's got me corrected here. Page 5, line 8, we put an exception in the state procurement code, and it's on line 8 and 9. So that's where we technically did the change, but that's the effect of the change.
Okay. Number 4.
Okay. The administration suggested that their hearing officers need to be under the same type of code that judicial officers are in some cases, where a person comes in and for whatever reason decides that the hearing officer isn't going to work for them. They get one preemptory challenge and can ask right up front for a different hearing officer. And so that language has been put in on page 10, subsection C. Probably something that other models have used, and there was some concern with only a battery of 9 hearing officers, you know, and maybe some skilled, maybe only a couple skilled in particular areas, if that preemptory challenge might cause a mechanical problem. The discussions within the administration were that they didn't think that it would. So we've added that.
Questions on 4?
Okay. 5. Page 11, line 12. The administration does a lot of hearings, and Senator Olson kind of touched on this. In rural areas and in a lot of areas of the state, we have hearings that aren't really the hearings intended under this bill. There's sort of informal hearings that happen at various levels of the administrative process. And this clarification in the definition of administrative hearings expands the definition to make sure that the legislature lets the administration know that we don't intend to affect those type of hearings. And a lot of those do occur in rural areas, Senator. We're looking for the higher level adjudication procedures where there's two parties and a hearing officer, and that's generally at a highly contested level of a state regulation. So I hope that gives you more comfort, Senator. Any questions on that?
Questions on 5?
Okay.
6?
Number 6 involves, let's see here, page 13. Andy would be best to speak to this, but basically what we tried to get at is there are some cease and desist authorities that we did not want to conflict with. And Andy, could you just take a moment, Mr. Chairman, with your latitude?
Please.
The amendment here is on page 13, and previously this is the provision governing cease and desist orders issued by the Department of Community and Economic Development, mostly on various regulated professions. And typically, the commissioner issues an order, and then you have a hearing to decide whether it's going to be made permanent, and that's what this governs. We had, as drafted originally, the drafter matched the language here with the jurisdictional portion of the bill that's on page 4 and 5. And in doing that, we discovered later that was unnecessary because the cease and desist orders only apply to certain boards and occupations, and that's described on line 16 on page 13. Unless you are a listed board or occupation within Title 8, then the cease and desist authority doesn't exist. So we were able to not specify which agencies would not be included in this provision because the existing law already restricts it to a certain group, and we're comfortable with that group. So that is the reason for that change. It's effectively a drafting error. Was corrected.
You have two perspectives here. You just heard one. My take on this is we shouldn't do anything we don't need to do. So, but that was an excellent explanation. Questions, I guess?
I understood your part.
Okay.
Okay.
7. Number 7. As we go into this transformation process, one of the things that has been brought to our attention is that we need to refer to these people of higher standards, the new model office, the entire process, as administrative law judges. Basically, they're hearing officers, but they're hearing officers in this case in the new model, and there are hearing officers that exist outside the new model, and the drafter did her best to clarify the difference between the two. They do the same types of jobs. They do them in different places. When they do them to the standards and in the place that we're creating in this bill, they will be referred to as administrative law judges. Questions?
Questions on seven. Senator Hoffman.
Hold on, seven. Were you done with everything here, or was that all the changes?
Eight to go.
David, where are you? Just finished seven?
Right.
Okay. Questions on seven?
I'll wait till it's done. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Bundy on seven?
I guess it does fit in here, administrative law judge. There's another bill going through the process on workers' comp, and that would create a panel of administrative law judges. Do you have an idea how this interrelates with the workers' comp revision?
Well, I don't at this point because we're not into those final phases where they have to be integrated, but I think it's worthy of future discussion as we get closer to the end of the process, Senator Bundy, how these two might, how confusion might arise, or I'm not sure how they're setting up their standards and authority. In this jurisdiction, though, it'll be pretty well laid out. So we'll need to take a look at that.
I encourage you. It's SB 311.
Okay.